Good evening. In the news tonight, testimony continues in the civil rights class action lawsuit over the NYPD's stop and frisk policy. A new report shows New York Police Department wastes resources over small-time drug arrests. The New York State Legislature raises the minimum wage. The New York City Council holds a preliminary budget hearing with the Department of Homeless Services. The Fukushima nuclear power plant's cooling system undergoes a temporary shutdown, and it's the 10th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. With these and other stories, I'm Linda Perry in New York, and this is the news for Tuesday, March 19th, 2013. Testimony continued today in the civil rights class action lawsuit, which puts the NYPD police practice of stop and frisk on trial. Nick Pert took the stand. He's a 24-year-old man of Jamaican descent who was stopped and frisked by the NYPD between 5 and 10 times, beginning when he was 16 years old. On his 18th birthday, the young man was surrounded by a group of police officers with guns drawn. They shouted, "Get on the ground." He and his cousin were then frisked. One of the officers looked at the birth date on Pert's ID and said sarcastically, "Happy birthday." More than 5 million stops in the past decade were made by police, mostly of Black and Hispanic young men. The lawsuit Floyd versus City of New York, brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights, seeks a court-appointed monitor to oversee changes on how the police make stops. Outside the courtroom today, Brooklyn leaders expressed support for the federal lawsuit, calling for an end to discriminatory policing. In a related story, according to a report released today, the NYPD spent 1 million hours during an 11-year period making 440,000 arrests for low-level marijuana possession. The report commissioned by the Drug Policy Alliance was at the request of the New York City Council and New York State lawmakers on how many hours were spent on low-level drug arrests. What that means is that 31 police officers working 8 hours a day for 365 days a year for 11 years made only one marijuana possession arrest. And the cost to New York taxpayers paying to make those arrests, $75 million a year. The report says the figure shows a huge waste of police resources. The NYPD did not respond to a request for comment on the Drug Policy Alliance's numbers. The report comes as New York State is considering decriminalizing small amounts of marijuana in public view. And The Nation magazine is reporting that New York City's police union has cooperated with the NYPD in setting arrest quotas for the department's officers, a practice that has played a direct role in increasing the number of stop-and-frisk encounters since Mayor Michael Bloomberg came to office. Patrolmen who spoke to The Nation explained that the pressure from superiors to meet quota goals has caused some officers to seek out or even manufacture arrests to avoid department retaliation. On Monday, the New York State legislative leaders and Governor Cuomo reached a tentative agreement to increase the state's minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $9 an hour over the next 3 years. It will be the first increase in the minimum wage since 2009. But while the increase is good news for the state's lowest paid workers, critics say the agreement, brokered by State Senator Joel Klein and the so-called Independent Democratic Caucus, will cost low-income workers more than $1 billion in lost wages. Speaking with WBAI's Andrea Sears, Mark Dunley, executive director of the Hunger Action Network of New York State, says unlike a bill favored by the Democratic majority in the legislature, the Senate bill spreads the increase out over almost 4 years and eliminates a provision indexing the minimum wage to inflation.
And all this is really due to Senator Klein, who decided to throw his support to the minority Republicans. And this is a very bad deal that he cut, and it really hurt low-income workers, and he should be held responsible for that. And then Governor Cuomo both failed to provide leadership last year, and this year he took the indexing off the table when he made his own proposal, which made it easier for the Republicans to then move on to the next pet issue, which is always to delay and do a phase-in rather than doing a minimum wage hike immediately.
Why is Governor Cuomo pretty much absent from this debate? He's not pushing for what would be best for low-wage New Yorkers.
Well, that's a big mystery. The short answer will be that apparently he feels that campaign contributions from business interests are more important than the needs of low-income people. I mean, he has shown some very great leadership on doing the same-sex marriage, which was quite controversial, especially a lot of opposition among the Senate Republicans, and earlier this year on gun control. Both of those were very difficult, controversial issues where he put his political leadership on the line and delivered over some substantial opposition among the Republicans. That was not the case with the minimum wage. First, he proposed not indexing it to inflation, which made the Republican jobs easier. And then when President Obama came out and proposed a $9 an hour federal minimum wage, he then further backed off from raising the state minimum wage, saying, oh, well, President Obama has made this a more complex issue, and we have to study this more now. And he just always seems to look for an excuse not to raise the minimum wage. And certainly he, along with Senator Klein, takes a lot of that responsibility for undercutting the deal that should have been easily done for $9 an hour plus indexing, because I think 32 Senate members have said they were willing to vote for $9 an hour, but Senator Klein and Governor Cuomo prevented that from coming to a vote.
What's the cost to the state of keeping the minimum wage low? Raising the minimum wage puts more people into the taxable income bracket. It also spreads the economic wealth around because people at that end of the wage scale tend to spend almost everything that they earn.
It does decrease tax revenues. There are certain taxes that might increase a little bit, like the Earned Income Tax Credit and the Child Care Tax Credit. But the extra income from the income tax, the sales tax, certainly is bigger than that. And plus, some of the costs of public benefits programs are reduced a little bit because a few less people might, say, be eligible for public assistance or maybe Medicaid, depending upon what their income ends up being. But the other big issue, as you pointed out, was the whole benefit of stimulating the economy. You may remember that when Congress was trying to do the economic stimulus several years ago, they actually officially determined that the best way to stimulate the economy was to increase food stamp benefits because that had the highest multiplier effect. Because when you give money to people to buy food, surprisingly they go out and they buy food to feed their families. And the same thing with low-income workers. When you give people having a hard time making ends meet because they got a sub-poverty wage and a little more money, they're not like the rich. They're not going to go invest that in tax shelters in the Bahamas or vacation trips in the Caribbean. They're going to go spend it at the local bodega, pay the landlord, pay the utility bill, buy some clothes for the kids. All that turns over the local economy. So taking several billion dollars out of the pockets of low-income workers, that's definitely going to hurt the economy and local taxpayers, too.
This is still a tentative deal. Is there any chance that the wage could be higher, that it could be indexed before this is all over?
If every listener of WBAI, after they contributed to the transmitter fund, was to call up our speaker of the state assembly and says, we need $9 now, that could change it. To be honest, once they announce a deal, it is definitely difficult to get them to change it, but I do think the speaker and certainly the governor would appreciate hearing from the voters about their positions on these issues. And if they really hear enough complaints that this is a bad deal, maybe they might listen to the 99% rather than the 1% apparently who are lobbying against us.
Mark Dunley is executive director of the Hunger Action Network of New York State. He spoke with WBAI's Andrea Sears. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica radio broadcasting at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. The New York City Council's General Welfare Committee held a preliminary budget hearing yesterday. First to report was the commissioner of the Department of Homeless Services, a city agency now handling record numbers of homeless families in its shelter system. WBAI's Rebecca Miles was there and files this report.
The Department of Homeless Services manages 9 city-run and 222 privately-run shelter facilities, providing outreach services 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as well as homeless prevention services through community-based programs. City agencies have to help close a $2.5 billion budget gap this year for fiscal year 2014, with cuts to services certainly to this agency, of 8%, or the equivalent to $34 million. Yet this is at a time when record numbers of people are staying in the shelter system. The city has to, by law, provide shelter for single adults. It doesn't have the same obligation to families. In a damning report by the Coalition for the Homeless, the agency is serving 50,000 people a night in its shelter system, 21,000 of which are children. 80% of the costs are being borne by New Yorkers through their taxes. But is it the best use of taxes when the Bloomberg administration, according to Mary Brosnahan, executive director for the Coalition for the Homeless, has no affordable housing program for those living in the shelter system? The Wall Street Journal on Monday reported the city is now leveraging federal funds to help pay for the city's shelter system. The commissioner, Seth Diamond, presented the department's strategy for the coming year with multiple programs and initiatives. But uppermost on city council members' minds was the absence of any affordable housing program, a point made in this exchange between Brooklyn City Council member Brad Lander and Commissioner Seth Diamond.
Councilmember Brewer had this implied question, but I guess I do want to ask it directly, which is, she seems more skeptical than I am that the state will ever help again. I believe when there's a plan with city cooperation, the state will help again. Have you presented to the state a proposal for a renewed homeless transitional subsidy, whether called Advantage or Next Generation?
We've seen no sense that the state is interested in such a program. They continue to put in their executive budget the same language. This is now the third year in a row that the governor's executive budget has put a prohibition on any type of rental subsidies in the executive budget that he has sent to the legislature. And so we have no sense that there is any willingness to have a discussion on this issue.
But you haven't asked or approached them or tried to organize a campaign to change that.
We are open to, we were the ones who fought for the program. We were the ones who said it should continue against their opposition. And they, again, have renewed their opposition every year by the way that they've presented both no money for such a program and a prohibition on such a program in language in the executive budget. So that their intent seems clear.
So the mayor has confronted many times in Albany when the sense of Albany is opposed to something that he wants. It has not, on the things he has wanted to change, been his approach to wait 2 years and just let the language reappear in the budget and do nothing proactive to change it. It's surely not going to change without some approach, without some proposal, without some organizing effort. And again, from watching the way the mayor has dealt with Albany on taxi cabs, on public education, on a whole range of things. I think it's not just Councilmember Brewer and on this committee that haven't been asked to go up to Albany and lobby, but if the mayor's not taking leadership, it's never going to happen. Meanwhile, we're spending $1 billion a year. And if we all agree that's what's needed is transitional housing resources, even if for those of us who believe it's got to be paired with permanent housing resources, we've just agreed to another year of rising homelessness numbers for singles and families and longer stays and more money spent by the city of New York on this in a way that doesn't produce any permanent housing or good options. So I guess that's what we're saying at this budget hearing this year, and I guess I think at least we should be honest with the people of New York that we're proposing to spend coming up on $1 billion for more homelessness and longer stays, and that's a depressing part of the budget, Dan.
Well, I don't think I agree with you that we need to work to move people out of the shelter system, that a year is nobody should be in the shelter system at all, and that the longer they are in, the worse it is for families who are uprooted from their communities and the children from their schools, and we want to return them as quickly as possible. And we have said from the beginning that we think a better way to spend the money that is allocated is to use some of it for a rental subsidy. That was our position 2 years ago. We have not found a willing partner in those discussions, and so we have moved to other efforts to try and help people.
And it would be easier to be enthusiastic about many of these programs, which I think I probably would be if it just didn't feel like nibbling at the margins. Thank you very much, as always, and thank you, Madam Chair.
That was City Council member Brad Lander in exchange with Department of Homeland Services Commissioner Seth Diamond. For WBAI's Evening News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting.
Four fuel storage pools at Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plants were without fresh cooling water due to a power outage. At present, TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, says it has restored power to the four fuel pools. But the electrical shutdown points to problems with temporary fixes. The thread in the pooling system breaking down is radioactivity raises the temperature of the water. Once water boils, radiation spreads into the atmosphere. This could result in even more contamination than when the plant shut down after the tsunami and earthquake struck Japan in March of 2011. Nuclear expert Gordon Edwards is president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. He says this is particularly worrisome. It's the loss of power that caused the meltdowns in the first place.
It seems that they haven't got on top of the problem of how to prevent station blackout. And this station blackout is very, very dangerous because the heat continues to be generated by the radioactive fuel. And there's no way that anybody can shut the heat off. The heat keeps driving the temperature up and up and up. So it's absolutely necessary that they have electricity to run the pumps to keep the water circulating, to keep that, to remove the heat as it's being produced in order to prevent damage to the fuel and release of radioactivity into the atmosphere.
Edwards says the biggest problem is that there was a simultaneous loss of power to four of the irradiated fuel pools.
And this is dangerous because the temperature keeps going up if the water is not circulating. So if the temperature goes up high enough, the fuel damages itself and you have serious releases of radioactivity into the atmosphere. That's the problem. Now, luckily, even though they lost power for about 24 hours or more than 24 hours, they have now restored power to three of the four pools, and they're working on the fourth one. So the present emergency is past, but one has to worry about the future because it was a station blackout, a loss of electrical power that caused the accident in the first place. All of the damage that was done at these reactors was self-inflicted damage by the radioactivity of the spent fuel overheating and causing meltdown simply because there was no electrical power to cool it.
This happens because you can never really turn a nuclear reactor off. You can turn off the main reaction, fission, but you can't turn off the radioactivity.
If the temperature goes up high enough, the fuel damages itself and you have serious releases of radioactivity into the atmosphere. That's the problem. Now, luckily, even though they lost power for about 24 hours or more than 24 hours, they have now restored power to three of the four pools, and they're working on the fourth one. So the present emergency is past, but one has to worry about the future because all of the damage that was done at these reactors was self-inflicted damage by the radioactivity of the spent fuel overheating and causing meltdown simply because there was no electrical power to cool it. Why is it even possible for four pools to lose their power simultaneously? It means there's something very incorrect about the planning. I think that the important thing here is that this is not just an incident that affects Japan. It affects the entire world. And consequently, the Japanese government should welcome an international inspection team with experts from around the world to go to Fukushima. And they should open the doors to these experts and let the world see what's going on from the inside and let these experts suggest the best method of procedure for the future.
Nuclear expert Dr. Gordon Edwards was one of the participants at Dr. Helen Caldicott's symposium on the medical and ecological consequences of the Fukushima nuclear accident. He is president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. Today marks the 10th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, which secured oil contracts for many Western oil companies after the ouster of the former U.S. ally Saddam Hussein. The day was marked in Iraq by multiple bomb blasts in the country's capital of Baghdad, mostly in Shiite neighborhoods, leaving 60 dead and 240 injured. A new CBS News poll found 54% of Americans say going to war with Iraq was not the right thing to do. Nearly 7 in in 10 back the war when it started. The military action 10 years ago quickly ousted Saddam Hussein, but led to years of bloodshed as Sunni and Shiite militants battled U.S. forces and each other. A decade later, Iraq's long-term stability and the strength of its democracy remain open questions. President Barack Obama is in Israel today, but said about the anniversary that the sacrifice of Americans gave the Iraqi people an opportunity to forge their own future after many years of hardship. In his statement, Obama said the nation honors the memory of nearly 4,500 Americans who died in Iraq, and he said the U.S. still needs to meet its obligations towards those who served in Iraq, including more than 30,000 wounded. He said the nation must improve treatment for traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder. Donald Rumsfeld, on the anniversary of the Iraq War, sparked a backlash on Twitter today. From his username at Rumsfeld Office, he tweeted, 10 years ago began the long, difficult work of liberating 25 million Iraqis. All who played a role in history deserve our respect and appreciation. Responses tweeted back to Rumsfeld called him a war criminal. Rob Ullman from Virginia tweeted, the absolute gall of you. Comedian Rob Delaney called Rumsfeld a blood-gargling psychopath. A person with the username That Worst Man tweeted, you and the rest should have been charged with war crimes. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Tuesday, March 19th, 2013. The news was produced tonight with Rebecca Miles, Andrea Sears, Jose Santiago, and Reggie Johnson. I'm Linda Perry in New York for the listener-sponsored WBAI Evening News.